When I first start to help you talk the Buddhist talk and guide meditation, I think it happened in Pogasi. I planned this meditation. I think it's for university students. And I think I deliver a wonderful guided meditation. Nobody said anything before, during, and even after the whole gig. Then only quite some time afterwards, then the organizer came forward and said, "I'm so sorry. There was something wrong with the PA system just now. And all we heard are static for the entire guided meditation." So basically they didn't hear a single word that I said. But nobody said anything. You could have said something at the beginning of the meditation, right? Make me look like a bloody idiot. Keep talking into the microphone where actually nobody heard nobody can hear what I'm trying to say. Right? So that's why I think, it's good in Singapore. Even they can't hear you, they still sit quietly and pretend to be hearing you or doing meditation. Then there's this other story I try to learn from. It's not my own experience. I have a friend who we're in Italy, so he was giving a talk in Italy. This is a different culture. You know, we Asian and he's Westerner. Then he tried to sort of adopt our Asian way of being modest, right? We always say, "Oh, I don't know. I really don't know anything. No, I know I'm here giving a talk, but I really don't know anything." And you must be very careful to copy that in a Western context. Because he started off the talk saying this thing, right? "Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure whether there's anything I could possibly say." Then someone raised their hand and said, "Can we have a change of speaker? Since you don't know, why do I have to sit through the whole talk, right?" So I don't know what he did afterwards, but I told myself, I would never put myself in this position. So I was going to say, I was to come clean. Actually, I do know something. I do have something to say to you, which is of value. Yeah. So that's why you never hear me start a talk saying, "Oh, I don't really know this topic very well." Whether I know or not, that's immaterial. I will try to project an air of confidence around what I say. Okay. Anyway, I'm serious. Is there any questions or comments? Yeah.
How to deal with not having many cravings or like wanting much?
Not having much craving or wanting. Do you think the problem with that is make you become lazy or unmotivated? Is that why you?
No, it's like feeling like you can accomplish a lot, but not really going for anything.
Yeah.
Because.
Yes, I know. I understand that very well. Because I also suffer from the cardinal sin of sloth. It's like, I think I can do it, but I don't really feel like doing it, no. So then I don't do it. And I'm quite happy about it, right? Yeah. Depends on how you look at it. What's from a conventional society point of view, there are various kind of expectations placed on us, and from the Buddhist point of view, a lot of those expectations are unrealistic, or they don't necessarily contribute to our genuine happiness. So for example, the Buddha is famous during his lifetime. He was encouraging people to go from the life of a householder to homelessness. He's actually creating homeless problems. This whole bunch of men and women wandering around the countryside without a home. They gave up their house. But these days we are all trying to buy property, right? We don't want to rent, we want to buy, and then we buy a few as investment property, right? So in a way, from that point of view, the Buddha is doing the opposite of what society expects of us. Yeah. So from a spiritual point of view, sometimes being not motivated towards some of those more conventional goals may not be a problem. in itself may not be a problem, especially if you don't think of it as a problem. Yeah. But of course, the Buddha is quite practical. He's not trying to starve everybody to death or his followers. So he did say that, but for his, especially for the monastics, they do need to make sure they have, I think it's four basic requisites. First, they must have access to a shelter, you know, to protect themselves from the weather. They must have access to clothing for modesty's sake, and also to protect the body from cold or heat or I want to say mosquitoes and so on. Yeah, clothing. Must have access to nutrients, food and water, because we need that to survive, and have access to medicine, because we do get ill. So you can translate that into, even in our modern context. So do we have this form, in whichever form we manage to get it? Because this is what we need to live at least a healthy life, you know? And then beyond that, in the teaching, in the case of the Buddha, then the aim is to discover for ourselves what is unconditional happiness. That's the whole thrust of his teaching. So that's why Buddhism has a kind of reputation for being kind of a bit antisocial, or definitely doesn't emphasize a lot of material progress, you know, because that's not what his interest is. Yeah. So if you look from the point of view this way of teaching, then yes, it does kind of emphasize a kind of lifestyle which is quite minimalistic, not very materialistic driven, you know, because basically it's to lessen our desires for things and to live a happy life. So like for example, you say, you know, there are many things I can accomplish, but I don't feel motivated to accomplish it. Then maybe the question to ask is, what do I want to do? What motivates me? As opposed to look at what don't motivate me, right? And what are the things I want to accomplish with my own life? Because if we follow the Buddha's teaching, we don't need to be successful to have a happy life, but we do need those four basic requisites. That's the thing that the And in the case of the Buddha, he's also very interesting. He makes his monastics, the original rules, require them to be dependent on others. In other words, during his time, but things have changed now, but during his time, the monks and the nuns are now allowed to go around earning money. Right? So just earning money means you become self-sufficient, you become autonomous, right? And it sort of defeat the whole purpose of becoming homeless. He create that lifestyle so that they are always dependent on others. So they can never forget the kindness of others. Because every meal comes to them purely through the kindness of others, the generosity of others. And that means that you have to be very humble, because your livelihood depends on another human being's kindness. So there is some kind of thinking going into it. But basically, you know, if you follow the monastic life, I'm not saying you need to, but if you look at it, it's not a very high achiever kind of lifestyle, right? They're not trying to, I mean, there are monks who try to build as many temples as possible, whatever, but it's just a matter of living your life in a positive way, not causing harm, not doing harm, and in a way that supports yourself and others to develop wholesome qualities, to live a good life, basically. And so, so I personally don't think that many things that we kind of society sort of expect us to do, if we think a bit deeper, are not quite necessary. But we nonetheless, we need to make sure that we take good care of ourselves through having the basic requisites, and then also identify for ourselves what is our primary motivation, what we want to do with this life. No, because in Buddhism, anyway, yeah, up to here, so far, okay. Yeah. So that's why, from a Buddhist perspective, I've been unmotivated towards a lot of things that maybe modern society expect of us. It's not necessarily a bad thing. For example, or something like that. Oh, okay. Owning multiple properties, right? Which is, you know, first you have the residence property, then you have your investment property, the second investment property. From a Buddhist perspective, I mean, some people do that. You know, quite a few of my friends are doing that. Yeah. But that is not a requirement for a happy life. So long as you have a place to stay, then if you are, but I'm not motivated to do that because I'm very lazy. To maintain so many properties, you need to work quite hard. Yeah. So I would say that being unmotivated towards many things in life is not necessarily a problem. But to be unmotivated towards everything in life, now that is a problem. Okay? It's because that means we don't have an aim, we don't have a sense of direction, we don't have any wish. We don't even have the wish to find genuine happiness for ourselves. Then that is a problem. Yeah. So that's not what I'm saying. But yeah. Okay.
Yeah. From here, how do you find your direction or motivation?
Well, like for example, today we're going to talk about unconditional happiness. So maybe you can take the cue from the Buddha's teaching on noble truth. The way he set up this, no, I change it. I talk about happiness, right? But actually, what he was talking about, and Buddhist teachers throughout the ages have been talking about, is about suffering. You know, so it's about, and in fact, there is this famous line from the Buddha when asked what did he actually teach people? What is his central message? He say, one thing only do I teach, suffering and the end of suffering. Okay? And so you can take that cue and say, so it's saying that, like, you can look at, like, let's say you say, oh, what should I do? What should be motivated? How should I motivate myself to work? Then maybe that could be something we can think about. Am I suffering? Am I unhappy? Am I miserable? What am I unhappy about? Now, what is stopping me from feeling contented, at peace, at ease with myself and with my life? So if I'm not contented, that means there must be something, some kind of unhappiness going on inside me, right? Some sort of dissatisfaction. Then we can investigate that. So there's suffering. So we can investigate that, and how can I arrive at a place where I'm free? You know? And I think he has quite a good advice, because at least personally, the reason why I started all this journey, why I took up meditation first before I studied Buddhism, is because I felt miserable. I was a teenager. As you know, teenager, when we are adolescents, we are miserable. We always feel that, you know, we are the most miserable person in the world. You know, if we are not having a good time, then we are miserable. So I was miserable. I don't know what I was miserable about, but I just thought this whole idea of meditation, you know, coming back and look at my own mind, because the mind is a source of misery and unhappiness. And that is such a cool idea. So if I can change my mind, maybe I can free myself from the misery and I can find happiness. So that motivates my journey. So maybe you can think along that line. So if you say, no, I don't know what motivates, what is my passion, what do I want to do? Then you can look at, then why is it that I don't want? What is the suffering that I want to be free from? What is the misery I want to be done with? So then that, and also suffering is a strong motivator. You know, that when we are in pain, we are motivated to do something. Like we have toothache, right? Not so long ago, I have toothache. I realized it's such a great motivator. Even though I don't like dentists, the toothache is so awful that I will go and make an appointment to see dentists. So Suffering is a great motivator, pushes us to seek freedom from suffering. I leave you to think about it.
One more.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, from this point, this motivation to escape suffering,
yeah,
is coming like from behind. You're running away from suffering.
Yeah.
And is there a difference in motivation that is somewhere ahead that you want to reach?
Like a more positive,
yes,
instead of a negative kind of. Yeah, yeah, you can. You know, for example, like after today's talk, if I manage to convince you unconditional happiness is so fantastic, right? So if I manage to dangle that carrot in front of you and you take it, you accept it, then that becomes a positive motivation. Some people are very motivated, for example, like within a Buddhist context. And I was reading a book downstairs, Pure Land. You know, like there's this teaching that after you die, if you do some Buddhist practice, you can arrive at this. It's basically the Buddhist version of heaven. And some people are very motivated, they want to go to heaven. They're very sure that they want to go to the Pure Land. You know, so that becomes their motivation. So it's a positive goal they set themselves, they motivate them to live their life. You know, to create the condition for that to happen. So, or the other one is like unconditional happiness. Sometimes if I ask myself, I have this one version of the goal, is I want to feel comfortable in my own skin in any situation. This is probably aggravated when I have to participate in some social event, which I really, really hate. Yeah. But then I have to go, right? Then it's very uncomfortable and very kind of full of anxiety and angst. No, then in those moments, then I really have a kind of positive goal where I say, how wonderful it would be if I can arrive at a place where I would be comfortable with myself in whatever situation. So that can become like what you say, that would be a positive goal, right? Or I phrase it positively, even though you can also phrase it negatively, is to be free from all those awful feelings and anxiety and uncertainty surrounding certain kind of situation. So that's the suffering. So escape from that suffering towards or arrive at a better place. Okay? Nice. So what is unconditional happiness? Anybody? Any audience participation? What do you think what is this funny thing called unconditional happiness? What could that possibly be? Do you think it's a thing, like something that you can grab hold of? Like,
just a state of mind.
A state of mind. Unconditional happiness being a state of mind. Okay, that's one possibility. But a state of mind, do you think that is conditional or unconditional? No, a state of mind, like for example, let's say a very peaceful state of mind. No, okay, let's imagine it. But when I'm awake, I can be peaceful, right? But if I'm asleep, what happened to the peacefulness? The peacefulness would disappear, isn't it? Then when I'm in pain, you know, will I still be able to retain that peaceful state of mind? Or will my mind be thrown into turmoil?
That's this where it's coming to. The state of mind, but I'm not sure.
A special state of mind.
No, the question is whether, like last week, whether you can sustain that state of mind.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the perspective shift is durable enough to.
Yeah. I mean, as I was saying, you know, I used to think that since suffering arises within the mind, so then happiness would also arise within the mind, right? The mind is the source of our happiness and suffering. Yeah, so that is possible. I'm not saying it's not possible, just sort of. Although mind or consciousness in Buddhism are impermanent. It's an impermanent phenomenon. It depends on, and also it depends on conditions. So consciousness itself is already a conditional thing. So I would think that, so it's actually quite difficult to talk about unconditional happiness or peace. And even if we equate it somehow with the mind, then you wonder, you know, how does the conditional mind, how does it relate to an unconditional happiness? So that is a question there. So let me give you I don't actually have a very precise answer, but I just talk it out, and then you can think about it for yourself. Okay. Now, I think to understand unconditional happiness or peace, we need to go back a little bit. So let me just sort of revisit what I talked about previously. We start with conditional happiness, right? Conditional happiness is usually maybe quite often associated with having something pleasant experiences. Yeah. Like for example, pleasant experiences to do with our senses, like eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. But in Buddhism, you can also think of pleasant experiences related to the mind. Like the mind has for example, you read a novel, right? You read a novel, and the story of the novel, although the novel is in to do through sight, but the stories that reverberate in your mind is your imaginations, right? And the story can be very engaging, and you really enjoy the story. So that is a pleasant experience, and I agree with you because I love to read books. So that is a kind of conditional happiness. Right? Now the thing about condition, there's nothing wrong with conditional happiness. In fact, I think the more you can get it, by all means, have as much as possible. But the issue with conditional happiness is, of course, they are impermanent. They don't last, they can't last. It depends on conditions. So when the conditions change, then that happiness will go away. I was thinking, if someone loves to climb mountains, right? So when you reach the peak of the mountain, you accomplish something, you feel very happy. Even though the climb up might be very dangerous and full of unpleasantness. So there is a great sense of joy and happiness and accomplishment through climbing mountain. But we call it conditional happiness, you know why? Then, first of all, you have to climb down that mountain, right? Then, by then, you will lose that happiness. So what you have to do, you have to go and climb another. You can climb the same mountain again, or climb another. But you have to do it again to get back that happiness. Because otherwise, it's just a memory of what has happened in the past. So that's sort of a bummer with conditional happiness. And then according to the Buddha, over and above that, we also we create suffering for ourselves in relation to our experiences, including conditional happiness. So we sort of mess things up for ourselves. If we just leave it as it is, there is a pleasant experience, we can enjoy it, but we tend to mess things up. Yeah. So because we have this this troublemaker that the Buddha called craving, which is the source of our suffering. Craving. So previously I was trying to explain, you can think of craving. Craving is like a bit like attachment. Right? I try to explain craving as resistance, our resistance to reality. And for example, for pleasant experiences, how we resist is the reality is pleasant experiences, they change, they fade, they disappear. They can come, but they can go, they have to go also, right? And so we resist it. By craving is we try to hold on to it, right? We try to make them last, right? Or we try to prevent them from going away, or we try to pack our life every moment to be full of pleasant experiences. And of course, we are bound to fail, right? It's not doable. So that is one form of craving, right? We resist the reality that our pleasant experiences will change, will fade. By trying to hold on to them, by trying to recreate them, right? And that creates problem for us. Then also, likewise, when our experiences are unpleasant, we don't like it, right? So we have another resistance, which is very understandable. We want to get rid of it. You know, we want to get rid of it, we want to do away with it. We simply don't want to experience anything unpleasant. So that's another resistance, another form of craving, which we can call aversion, anger, or in a very extreme case, we can call it hatred. It's a way of trying to destroy the unpleasantness or destroy the sources of that unpleasantness. Right? So these are our cravings. And you can sort of understand why the Buddha identified that. Because of our craving, we mess up our life. Not only do we mess up when we experience pleasant experiences, we also mess it up when we experience unpleasant experiences. And out of craving comes suffering. Because you can imagine attachment and aversion or anger, hatred, these are not very pleasant states of mind. Yeah? So when we experience them, we are actually dissatisfied, we are unhappy, we are probably very upset also. Yeah. Okay, so that is, and so that's the problem with we have problem with conditional happiness. So what is unconditional happiness? According to the Buddha, is when we put an end to craving, we manage to release our resistance to reality. We do away with craving. We no longer react with craving. Then out of that will come what he calls the end of suffering, or we can call it unconditional happiness or unconditional peace. Now, and when I was preparing this talk, I think I was telling myself, if I describe it this way, it's not actually very attractive to most people. Because, and I agree, I used to think to myself, the way we achieve happiness in Buddhism, we always kind of think like, we thought that maybe through studying and practicing Buddhism, we achieve happiness because we get what we want, right? I pray to Buddha, then I will get everything I want, or I can get rid of things that I don't want, right? I won't have misfortune, I won't get sick, I don't even need to grow old, and then better still, I don't have to die, right? The mantra and all this kind of thing. So it's like our amulet against all the unpleasant things and a way of getting all the things we want. Yeah, that's maybe quite a very common idea of happiness. So I, after studying Buddhism for some time, I sort of realized that actually that the Buddha cheated us. That's actually not the happiness he's offering us. So I used to joke and say, actually the way we achieve happiness in Buddhism is not by giving you what you want, but it's by changing your definition of happiness. Right? So by changing our definition of happiness, that's how we arrive at being happy. So actually the happy that we achieve is not the happy that we set out to look for. Yeah. But somewhere along the way, the definition has been changed. So it doesn't sound so fantastic, isn't it? No. Maybe my initial definition of happiness is, I'm a bit obsessed with money, to earn, to get lots and lots of money, right? And somewhere along the way, you figure out that that's not going to happen. But nonetheless, I still can be happy without loss and loss of money. So there is a change in the definition of happiness. And I think unconditional happiness is like this. It's related to changing the way we see things. So instead of resisting reality, what happens is we can be in touch and be able to just acknowledge reality as it is. So I have this image where normally what we do is, let's say this is reality, something that is ever changing. So whenever we get to know about it, we resist it, we turn away from it, we try to hold on to some idea in our mind. We want to be young forever. Then you realize that's not going to happen. No. I'm going to get older and older. Or worse still, I'm going to die, right? So I resist it. I'm holding on to life. I'm trying to stay alive for as long as possible. Then someone asks you, what's the point? What do you want to do? I don't know, but I just want to stay alive, right? So this is the image I have in my mind. Craving is resisting reality and grasping or holding on to certain ideas we have in our mind. So the opposite is when we release, we let go of that craving, is we come back and we be in touch with reality just as it is, and we are able to fully accept it as it is, right? So that means, in other words, whatever is served up at this moment, be it something pleasant or something unpleasant or something neutral, we're okay with it, right? We're okay, we don't have to overreact. We can respond differently, of course, no? But we don't have to overreact against it. We don't have to suffer over it. So for example, if it's a pleasant experience that served up to me in this moment, I can enjoy it while it lasts. Yeah? If it's an unpleasant experience, well, I can investigate. Because usually pain is a signal that something is not good or not right. So then a good way to relate to pain or unpleasantness is to pay more attention. Hey, what is happening here? Or has something gone wrong? Am I hurting my own body? Right? Or maybe, and usually when we experience like unpleasant smell, unpleasant taste, maybe whatever it is, maybe harmful to me. So with unpleasantness, maybe it's calling out to us to give it more attention, to be more attentive, and to figure out, okay, then what do I need to do about it? Maybe I need to, for example, you smell smoke, right? It's not pleasant. Maybe instead of trying to, this reminds me of a funny story. So when I'm living in Sydney, I live in this house, which is also like the center, Buddhist center. Yeah, because it's a public place, it has a fire alarm. So I live in that, right? So every time, quite often in the middle of the night, the fire alarm will go off. Right? And it has a bell on the outside also. So it means the whole neighborhood will hear this alarm. And so what do we do? It's very unpleasant experience, right? So our knee-jerk experience, it's very funny, but it's to switch off the alarm. It's not whether to look whether there is fire, but it's to switch off the damn alarm. So we will rush down, get the key, open this thing, and switch off the alarm. Or alarm off, then what do? We go back to sleep. So we always assume that it is a false alarm. We never go and check, okay, this alarm is which zone? So is there anything burning in that zone? Never. The unpleasant experience is not the fire. The unpleasant experience is the fire alarm. So our knee-jerk experience reaction is to switch it off. We switch off and sometimes we leave it off. Yeah. So that wouldn't come on again. Then we go back to sleep. Until one of our fellow residents said, first of all, this is violating fire insurance, because basically we switch off the fire alarm, right? Which means it's not working. So we will void our fire insurance if we do have a fire. And secondly, she insists that we must go and check whether there is a fire or not. Because most of the time, in fact, so far, actually we do have fire before. Most of the time it's false alarm. But we do actually have fire before, caused by tea light candle, which is why in this center it's banned. Tea light candle is a potential source of fire. Yeah. So what happened in this with unpleasant experiences, instead of reacting like what I would say, which is to get rid of the unpleasantness, maybe a better way is to pay attention to what that unpleasantness is and what is it trying to tell us. For example, in the case of a fire alarm, I mean, not necessarily a false alarm, but a real alarm will be telling us that there could be a potential source of fire, right? It could detect smoke or it could detect heat. So maybe what it's called for is we need to go and look at whether there is really a fire or not. That's the whole point of a fire alarm, right? Yeah, before we switch off the alarm. Yeah. Okay, so likewise with other unpleasant experiences in our daily life, we don't have to resist it. We have to acknowledge that this is unpleasant, take a good look at it, and then decide what to do. We don't have to stay there and suffer, of course, no. So if it's a pain in the body, and if changing your posture can relieve the pain, why not? You can do that. Which is why I try to tell people, if you sit in meditation and you notice right at the beginning that you are not comfortable, you know, your body is trying to tell you there's something wrong with this posture. Maybe it's good to listen to your body and decide, or maybe I can adopt a different meditation posture. One that's more supportive and more comfortable for me in meditation. So, and then we can also encounter many moments of neutral experiences, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Acknowledging reality is to acknowledge them. Those are neutral moments. Usually when we encounter neutral experiences, one of the common reactions that we have is we say, oh, I'm so bored. There's nothing interesting here. Yeah. People can be driven mad by boredom, right? Yeah. But boredom is actually, one thing why we find certain moments boring is because psychologically we are refusing to pay attention. Right? We are saying that there is nothing here that interests me, so I refuse to pay attention to that, which is why we are bored. Right? If you don't pay attention, then there is nothing that will come to you that would interest you or that would bring forth a stronger kind of feeling. Right? And so in meditation, a lot of time, people who are new to meditation on the breath, they find the breath very boring. Just breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. What's so interesting about it, right? But I have meditated on the breath for, let's say, 30 years, right? Now the breath for me is very interesting. I have built a lot of positive associations with the breath. So the breath is like a fascinating thing, you know. Or maybe not the breath directly, but as you be mindful of the breath, things start to change, you know. The body starts to relax, the mind starts to calm down. So all these things that is happening around the breath are very interesting to me. Right? So then, at least for me, the breath is no longer a neutral experience. It has taken on almost a pleasant experience because there are great interest on my part. And also this kind of familiarity with mindfulness of the breath practice. Okay. So that's my idea of what happens when craving ends. When craving ends, every moment, be it a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experiences will always be okay. Right. So that's why it's almost like you achieve a state of peace which is undisturbed by whatever that is happening. So when you encounter pleasant experience, that's okay. I can enjoy. When you encounter unpleasant experience, that's also okay. I just have to pay more attention and see what I need to do about it. And when you encounter a neutral experience, well, that might be a signal for me to maybe give it more attention to find out what might be of interest in that moment. So it's like sometimes people say people have different ways of expressing this state. Some people say like everything is okay. So regardless of whatever happened in that moment, you can always reply that it is okay. And therefore, in those moments, you are not suffering. There is no need for you to resist that reality. You are at peace with it. And this is not dependent on the condition, not dependent on whether that moment is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Hence, the term unconditional happiness. Or I rather prefer to call it unconditional peace. Okay? Not very exciting, isn't it? No. There's no light, no firework, no bliss, no superpower. No, you don't become Superman or Superwoman, you know, and save the world and do anything you want and then don't have to die. Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. But not like that. In fact, it's almost sounds so mundane. But I find that, I actually find very attractive this way of life. Yeah. very hard to achieve because I still have lots and lots of habituated reactions. So I still get angry, which means that I still have cravings, I have lust, I still have sloth, like, oh, everything is not interesting. I don't do it. Yeah. So I still have all those habituated reactions to what's happening in my life. Yeah. And those, of course, those reactions bring me suffering. So I'm not 100% at peace with myself, with my life. But if I think of it, if I imagine the goal to be like this, for me at least, I find it quite, quite attractive, quite satisfactory. Because it conveys a sense, although a sense of deep contentment. You know, because you are happy with whatever. I mean, you can go and do different things, but whatever it is that arrives, you're perfectly fine with it. You are contented with it. So it has a underlying sense of satisfaction. Okay? And also it conveys a sense of safety and security. Because it's almost like nothing can dislodge you from it. Because as I say, you are okay with pleasant experiences, you are okay with unpleasant experiences, you are okay with neutral experiences. In fact, it say that someone who is enlightened, who achieves this state of unconditional peace, even death is not a fearful thing. Death is just yet another thing that happens. You know? And you will be able to face death without fear, which I thought is also very attractive to me. Because I do have fear of death. I mean, I don't think about it, but there are occasions in life where this fear arises and it's very strong, so I know, oh, I do have it within me. So it would be nice to be able to face death without fear. So that is just a very kind of brief description of how I imagine unconditional peace or happiness to be. I don't actually call it happiness because it's not like you are, you know, it's not those jolly, jolly, cheerful, kind of happy. No, it's not. It's almost a very kind of like anti-climax, I don't know. But for me, it's very attractive. Yeah. So far, okay, you're with me? You have some idea what I'm getting at? I don't call it a state of mind because if the mind is not fixed when you achieve this state of unconditional peace, the mind is still able to respond to things. So the mind is, if pleasant experiences, I can respond by enjoying it. Unpleasant experience, I can respond differently. So the mind is changing. The mind is, it's not like the mind is stuck in a certain state. In fact, the mind is even more flexible and responsive when we achieve this state of unconditional peace. The mind is not, don't need to hold on to anything. Don't need to hold on to a particular feeling. Don't need to hold on to a particular state. The mind is almost like liberated and it can just, is free to respond in whatever way that is maybe most helpful or most appropriate to the situation you find yourself in.
So it sounds like, or it feels like, a state of spaciousness.
Spaciousness, yeah.
A bit of equanimity. Equanimity as well.
You're trying to recipe to make the state of.
Is that,
yeah, there is equanimity.
What I get is that you probably have to come back again and again to remind yourself
about it,
or potentially it could over time be effortless. It could be effortless over time.
Yeah. Actually, you don't need to imagine it because what happens is we just need to come to it because it's always available,
yeah.
It's unconditional. So you don't have to, you don't actually, I just try to describe to give you some idea, but you don't have to imagine it. Just the way to achieve it is not by imagining it and try to adjust yourself into it. But it's, later we'll look at how do we achieve it. Yeah. But it's by implementing the practice that allow us to get in touch with it. It's almost like it's always here. In fact, sometimes people say it's right in front of your nose. No, but we don't know how to get to it. And of course, when we get to it, we will lose it because we get distracted by our habits. But each time we get in touch with it, it's like it affirms to us, oh, this is possible. Then we get distracted by our old habits. Then we find our way back to it. So it's this kind of, sometimes I call it a toggle. You find your way into a place or a state that is really wonderful. And then the next moment, we get distracted, like meditation like that. We get distracted, and then we get caught up in our reaction, then we lose it, right? But we can also find our way back to it. So this toggling. But of course, the more we do it, the longer we are able to abide within it. And it becomes the default state for us. In fact, it sounds like the way I describe it doesn't do justice to it. Because within this state, we can experience what in Buddhism we call the wholesome state. In fact, those qualities can arise effortlessly. One of them is equanimity. Under certain situations, we will respond with equanimity. We can respond with loving kindness, right? So not only are we peaceful, but we can also be filled with loving kindness. We can respond with compassion. We can respond with joy. Then other wholesome qualities could be faith, could be a sense of conscience that restrain us from doing harmful actions. There is a quality of consideration for others. So these two say to be the guardian of the world, but they keep us to our ethical conduct. So we either avoid harmful action because of our inner conscience, our sense of self-respect, or we avoid harming others out of consideration for others. Okay. And then there are also qualities like you can experience enthusiasm. It's not like everything you're half dead like that. You could have arouse energy. You can, in fact, like the Buddha is full of energy. He achieved enlightenment when he was 35, and he spent the next 45 years walking around, just keep walking and walking and walking from one place to another teaching. That takes a lot of energy. I was thinking about it. He refused to sit on any vehicle during his lifetime, because in the old days, vehicle is either drawn by human being or drawn by animal. And he doesn't want to inflict the kind of suffering on others. So he walked himself wherever, to the palace or to the village, and he walked himself all the way to the place where eventually he passed away in Kushinaga. He was already very ill, yeah. So what was I saying? So we can respond with enthusiasm, we can respond with kindness, with compassion. So it doesn't as experiencing unconditional peace doesn't deny us all these different positive emotional response to the things that is happening in our life. A good example is actually, not that I'm not saying that he's enlightened, but a good example is actually to look at the Dalai Lama. Yeah. So there was a psychologist who sort of sat in together with him when he giving what they call audience or interview with different people coming to see the Dalai Lama. This psychologist, his name is called Paul Ekman. He specialized in studying emotions, but especially facial expressions of emotion. In fact, he wrote a book like how do you detect someone is lying just based on the changes in their facial emotions. And then he observed the Dalai Lama. He says that he was very amazed that this person has this marvelous ability to express a wide range of emotions, and that his emotions is very fluid. So one moment someone may come and talk to him about some philosophical thing, and then he would have certain kind of response to this person. The next moment, someone might share with him something really wonderful, and he find out they are a joke, and he can laugh with him, he's very happy. Then the next person come along, well, maybe a Tibetan, they just escaped from Tibet, and share with him their suffering, all the losses and terrible suffering, and he may cry with them. You know? And then this person left, and then another person come, then again, the emotion, the response change. Most of us, we cannot do it like this, because our emotions linger with us. We are not so, we don't let go so easily. We talk very much, we hold on to our memories, hold on to the different feelings a bit longer. But this psychologist, Paul Ekman, was amazed at how flexible and responsive the Dalai Lama's experience or responses to the different people. And for me, that is a sign of spiritual maturity, you know, that because life is always changing. And at each moment, we are called or asked to give a different response. Right? And most of the time, we can't do it because we are stuck in the past or we're stuck in the future. Or, you know, so our response is not in sync. That's why it's needed in that moment. You know, or sometimes we don't respond fast enough, or we are very caught up in the previous reaction, we haven't get over it, you know? Which is why, you know, sometimes we got angry and then with someone, but our anger spill over to the next person that we met. Yeah, so innocent, the poor thing didn't do anything, but just talked to me at the wrong time and wrong place, and then got a very bad treatment from me because I'm still upset. Yeah, so the ability to let go of certain emotions in order to meet this new moment is a sign of accomplishment. Yeah. And so, so I think even though my description of unconditional peace sounds very flat, but actually within it, there can be a lot of different emotional experiences. Yeah. Sounds attractive or not? Doesn't turn you off completely. Yeah. I mean, nobody walk out, so it's okay. Like. How do we achieve unconditional peace? How do we, maybe in our experience, at least have some taste of it, get in touch with that unconditional peace that is actually available to us? This is also another idea. Because it's unconditional, you don't have to feel that you have to wait a long time in order to get it. There will be people who say, oh, I'm not pure enough. I'm not moral enough, not ethical enough, not good enough, basically, to encounter or to experience unconditional peace. But the fact that it's unconditional means that may not be true, right? Maybe in one moment, of course, maybe not forever, but in a moment, your conditions, things may change such that it may allow you a mini breakthrough, allow you to have a taste of what that could be. So how do we do that is... usually, I present a meditation which I call touch and release. Right. So I'm going to elaborate on the meditation. Touch, usually what it means is to return your attention and to be in touch with what is happening. Right. Usually it's to do with the body, like, because I ask people to notice sensation at the crown, at the forehead, at the throat, the right shoulder. This big long list that I get you through, right? At each place, I ask you to return your attention, to be in touch with the sensations there, usually synchronized with the breath. Right? Breathe in, be in touch with the sensations there, and then breathe out, I ask you to say the word release, touch and release. So I call this meditation touch and release, touch and release, touch and release. And I think we can use the same idea. Know, to help us to come closer to unconditional peace. That's why we have the two ingredients: in touch with reality of this moment, which could be the body, could be the breath, or could be some feelings or emotions, or could be some thinking that's happening in your mind. So what we need is to be able to come back and be in touch, be aware of those experiences, which is happening here and now, which is our reality, this moment. So in touch, and as we breathe out, we say the word in our mind, release. What are we releasing? We are releasing our craving, right? Releasing our resistance to what we find here, to our current reality. Does it make sense? So for example, I come back and be in touch and I say, oh, this feels very nice, very relaxed. Yeah. Right. So in breath, be in touch, out breath, release. Well, you don't have to do anything. The word release is just like, it's not so much asking you to do something, but it's just a reminder that maybe, you know, some of the craving that might arise at that moment, craving that try to hold on to that pleasant experiences, because it's instinctive, right? But as we say the word release, maybe that might remind our body and mind, hey, actually, maybe I don't have to crave. I can let go of my craving. And just let myself enjoy the pleasant sensation while it lasts. Yeah. And similarly, if I encounter unpleasant sensations, I can be in touch with it, I can just notice it, acknowledge, oh, shoulders feels very tight. No? And then I say the word release. I remind myself, but I don't have to react with aversion, right? Which is what we try to do, we tend to do. Go away. No, go away. We may say the word, sometimes it manifests in the way we say the word release. Like almost like a command like that. Release, release. We're trying to get rid of that tension in the shoulder. Yeah. Doesn't work, I can tell you. Never work, okay? So instead of doing it, we can just say the word release and then let it go. Yeah. What we are releasing is we release the aversion, release this tendency to make things happen. We say, actually, we don't have to do this. But our body knows how to relax. And in time, when the conditions are right, this tension will go by itself. So I don't have to resist it now. Okay, so that is the idea. Touch and release. Touch help us, remind us to come back and be in touch with our reality. Release remind us that we don't have to respond with craving. We don't have to respond by resisting what we find here. Right? So why don't we try something different? We try to be in touch and not crave, not resist. Then we can, and it's almost like an experiment. Then we say, hey, what will happen? You know, how will my experience change in the meditation? You may find that, at first maybe not so obvious, but if you just try to repeatedly come back to these two ideas for practice, touch, be in touch, be aware, be present with what is happening, what is unfolding in your life at this moment, and release. What happens if I do not resist that moment? If I do not try to hang on to it, or do I try to push it away, or do not sort of like resist it by saying, oh, I'm so bored, I want to be somewhere else. What happens if I let go of those resistance, those craving responses? What will happen in my own experience? What will arise? What will I find here? Personally, I find that, just as an example, I find that I actually relax much deeper, but always with a delayed reaction. I always say I'm slower. I have to go all the way to the foot before my shoulder relaxes. But hey, it's still good, right? I still welcome it. Yeah. And because I'm lazy, this one, I'm not doing anything. All I'm doing is in touch and remind myself, release. Very little effort involved, right? Almost I'm aiming for effortless meditation. But yet, each time I go, just to go through the whole body in this way, hey, the body feels much more settled, right? And the mind takes a bit longer, okay? Then we can continue the same exercise of touch and release. But in this case, we can say, we can use the breath, right? We can say, let me come back and be in touch with my breath. And then on the out breath, I say the word release. I encourage my body and mind to deepen the sense of release. I don't know how they're going to do it. I'm not going to do it because I don't know how. But I'm just reminding my body and mind. Try to release. I don't know how you do it, but maybe you can consider. Release your resistance to what is happening here and now. Then what sort of new experience may come up for you in the meditation? Maybe you might suddenly realize that, hey, you know, the mind, all this thinking get less and less. You know, you are actually calming down, which is sort of a nice discovery. Sometimes I discover that there is a kind of contentment that's already here. Contentment is because, you know, I'm not trying to change anything. I don't have expectation of myself achieving anything. No, I don't have to say I must achieve perfect concentration, I must achieve no thought at all. I don't have only those expectations, or I release all those expectations. So whatever is here, it's perfectly fine. Hence, some of you have heard I say, every session of my meditation is a good session. It's good. I really think it's good. Even though my mind is all over the place, from a certain perspective, it's good, right? Because it's the reality of my mind. My mind just happened to be a bit excited that day. Or a bit, you know, usually it's excited, it's always thinking about all the stuff. And if I don't resist it, it's not such a big problem, isn't it? If I acknowledge that my mind is restless today, by acknowledging it, it's not a problem. Right? Or my mind is very sleepy. I always tell people, never mind, I'll just lie down. Sleep long, what's the problem? No, maybe you're tired, then you just sleep and then you wake up, you feel much better. Isn't that nice? No, don't have to resist sleepiness. And also because I know you didn't intend to sleep, right? The sleepiness come to you. Because if I'm not talking, because I'm talking and that's why I stay awake, right? If I'm sitting on your side, I also fall asleep, right? Because there's nothing to keep me awake. And maybe, you know, our busy lifestyle means usually at this time of the day, we are tired. You know? And so the natural response from the body is to fall asleep. In itself, there is nothing wrong about it. And if you do not resist that experience, then there is no problem. You fall asleep, there's no problem. You wake up, there's no problem. You don't fall asleep, also no problem. And if you think about it, if you approach this way, with this kind of approach, it is not difficult for you to come to a place or a state in which you are at peace with whatever that is happening. So in fact, you might actually enjoy whatever is happening and feel very at ease with yourself. But enough of me talking. Let's give it a try, right? We do a meditation on touch and release, and I'll guide you through it. So first step is posture. Second step is return your attention to your body, to the different parts of the body, touch and release. And the third one is using the breath as the support and practice this idea of touch and release in relation to our breath. Okay, so let's see what happens. So let's start by finding a suitable posture for our body. Adjust your body in whichever way, allow it to settle comfortably into this posture. Whatever posture you adopt, try to make sure that your back feels comfortable. So since we are sitting, we try to have our back in such a way that it is naturally upright, not slouching, but also don't feel the need to tense up your back muscles. You don't have to consciously tighten those muscles because it will make you feel very uncomfortable. So just allow the back to assume a natural upright position. Rest your hands maybe on your knees or in your lap, whichever way that provides support for your arms, so that your shoulders can be relaxed. Feel free to close your eyes completely if you want to. Or if you are more familiar with other ways of placing your eyes, like half open or fully open, then that is also fine. So just allow your body to find its way into this posture. See if you can become aware of sensations at the different touch points between your body and your seat, your body and the ground. So at those touch points, see if you can notice that your body is resting on something solid, firm, and stable. These are qualities we associate with the earth. I feel that they are here to support your body, to hold you up, keep your body well balanced and safe in this posture. When the body feels secure in the posture, it can begin in its own time a natural process of loosening up. It can unwind and let go of some of the unnecessary tightness, tensions, and just adjust itself so that it will settle down comfortably into the posture. So as usual, I will guide you through the meditation, but feel free to ignore what I'm saying if it is not helpful or not suitable to your experience. So we start by placing our attention at the crown, the top of the head, and synchronize with our natural breath. Just imagine each time you breathe in, see if you can allow yourself to be in touch, to be aware of sensations at the crown. And when you feel yourself breathing out, see if you can remind yourself, your body and mind, to release. So breathe in, be in touch with sensations at the crown, breathe out and release. Then moving downwards, place your attention at your forehead, somewhere between your eyebrows. Breathing in, be in touch, be aware of sensations at your forehead, and maybe also sensations in the rest of your face. Breathing out, you can say the magic word, release, encouraging the muscles of your face to release any unnecessary tightness or tension. And maybe you can become aware of a softening of the face, a sense of ease or comfort or relaxation coming into your own face. And then moving further down, we place our attention at our throat. Breathing in, be in touch, be aware of sensations at the throat, as well as sensations in the neck. Breathing out, we remind ourselves to release. Then we extend our attention to our right shoulder, just pick a spot at the right shoulder. As we breathe in, we allow ourselves to become aware, to come back in touch with sensations at our right shoulder. It could be the top of the shoulder, the front, the back of the shoulder, sensations at the shoulder joint. Breathing out, we try to remind ourselves to deepen the sense of release. Moving on, we place our attention at our right elbow. Breathe in, be in touch. Out and release. And throughout the process, our mind most probably will wander off, thinking about this and that, or start to drift towards sleep. So long as you become aware of that, you can invite your attention to come back. Come back to, in this case, your right elbow, be in touch with here and now, and as you breathe out, release. Moving further down, place your attention at your right wrist. Breathe in, be aware of sensations here. Out and release. We extend our attention into our right hand. Breathe in, be in touch with sensations in the right hand, the palm of the hand, the back of the hand, down the fingers. Breathing out, we release. Imagine releasing the weight of the right arm. Just allow it to rest comfortably on its support. Switching side, place our attention now at the left shoulder. Breathe in, be aware, be in touch at the left shoulder, out and release. Moving down to the left elbow, touch and release at your own pace. Continuing down to the left wrist, touch and release. Extend our attention into our left hand. Breathe in, be in touch, be aware of sensations in our hand, out and release. Now release the weight of your left arm, allow it to rest comfortably on its support. Now we place our attention at the center of our chest, and what we call the heart center. Breathing in, be aware of sensations here. Maybe you become aware of the beating of your own heart, the movements of the chest. Breathing out, remind yourself to release. Throughout the meditation, whenever we get distracted, it will be an excellent opportunity to invite our attention to come back. Now we come back to the body, come back to here and now, to be in touch with our reality of this moment. So let our attention move further down to the abdomen, somewhere around the navel region, somewhere within the abdomen. Place your attention there, breathe in, be aware, be in touch of sensations, out and release. Now Let our attention continue further down, deeper to the base of our spine, at the tip of our tailbone. Breathing in, be aware of sensations here. Breathing out, release. At this point, see if you can, as you breathe out, imagine releasing the weight of your pelvis. Just allow it to rest comfortably on your seat. Extending our attention now to the right hip joint. Just make a guess where it is. Place your attention at that spot. Breathe in, be aware. Breathe out to release. The attention move further down to the right knee. As before, touch and release at your own pace at the right knee. Moving down to the right ankle, repeat the same thing, touch and release. Into the right foot, touch and release, releasing the weight of your right leg, allow it to rest comfortably on the floor. Then we switch to the left side, starting at the left hip joint, breathe in, be in touch, out and release. Moving down to the left knee, touch and release. Moving further down to the left ankle, touch and release. Rest your attention at your left foot, be in touch as you breathe in, release as you breathe out. And release the weight of your left leg, just let it rest comfortably on the floor. Now that we have returned our attention, reconnect our body with our mind. We allow our body to continue to settle down, releasing unnecessary tension, tightness. And we rest our mind, our attention, on the support such as the breath, so that we can experience fully each in-breath and out-breath. And whenever we notice an out-breath, we can remind ourselves with the word release. Breathing out, we can deepen the sense of release, allowing body and mind to release any of the reactions, release our resistance to what we find here and now in our present reality. whenever you notice that your attention is drawn away from the breath, from here and now, quite often by our thoughts to the past or future, some ongoing inner commentary, invite your attention to come back here and now, maybe to the breath, so that once again you are aware of your in-breath and out-breath. And remind yourself with the word release, especially when you breathe out, that you can release your resistance, your craving towards whatever is happening here and now. So coming back to the breath, coming back to here and now, be in touch, be aware, and you may notice different things. Maybe sounds come into your awareness, maybe bodily sensations, pleasant or unpleasant. Is it possible for us to stay in touch with what is happening here and now? And now and then, as you breathe out, remind yourself, your body and mind, with the word release. Release our resistance to what is unfolding here and now. So coming back to the breath, be in touch with the breath, and in so doing, be in touch with what is happening here and now for you. As you breathe out, remind yourself with the word release. We are releasing our resistance to what is happening here and now. We also releasing our expectations towards our meditation, trying to get to somewhere, get to some experiences. If you can, as you prefer, release those as well. Allow your mind, your attention to settle back, just in this moment, here and now, be in touch with a deepened sense of release. And then finally, see if you can, with your attention, be in touch with your body. Notice how your body is feeling at the end of this meditation. See if you can acknowledge and appreciate any pleasant feelings in the body, any sense of relaxation or ease or comfort. And also important to acknowledge any unpleasant sensations in the body, areas of tightness or tension. Just allow them to be, acknowledge their presence. And likewise, check in and be in touch with the state of your mind. What is happening in your mind, your consciousness? Do you notice quite a bit of sleepiness or drowsiness, which is fine? Maybe you notice quite a lot of activities in the mind, especially in the form of thinking. Or maybe you discover a sense of relative stillness or silence and calmness within your mind. And then we can conclude with a dedication, thinking in your mind, may anything positive and helpful that come out of this meditation, may they linger in my body and mind, may they continue to benefit me long after this meditation is over. Okay, so that is 25 minutes of meditation on touch and release. So I like to think that sometimes meditation can be quite simple. Not easy, but simple. So all it needs is for us to come back and be in touch with what is happening here and now. Could be in relation to the breath or could be any other kind of object of meditation, but it always involves attention, awareness to be in touch. And then the other element of it is release. It's how it can be very complicated, but can be very simple. But it's all about releasing all these unnecessary things, you know, all the resistance, which is the add-on to this moment. So the more we release them, the more at peace and at ease we are, and the more we allow the experiences of meditation to just sort of happen. Yeah. That's my simple-minded summary of meditation. And my idea of unconditional peace or happiness is that it is basically reality itself, our reality. Of one moment to another, maybe pleasant, maybe unpleasant, maybe boring or whatever, neutral. It doesn't matter what it is. It is what it is, right? And so long as we do not add on this extra thing, which is craving, as the Buddha said, the reality of that moment is what it is. It's almost like you don't add another hate on top of your own hate, you wouldn't have a problem, right? What we have here is the reality. But often we are not satisfied with the reality. We want to add something onto it. We want to get rid of something. So we have all this wanting or craving, which sort of mess up the reality. And then we lose touch with what is real. And get caught up in what is unreal, and that's when suffering really, really hit us. Yeah. So if you take away all the craving, all the resistance, you're simply returning what is already here. Yeah. And by being in touch with what is already here, that is how we can find the most deeper sense of security and safety, because this is what is real. Right? Those things that we imagine or we think about or we dwell on or we get really anxious, a lot of it is our mind created or thought created stuff. I mean, if you allow, if let's say I have some anxiety issue, if you leave it to my mind, I can really work my way up to great suffering. But the reality of this moment is nothing much is happening. So quite often I notice that's how I create suffering for myself. I think myself into suffering. Then after I, when I finished, I said, what's that all about? You know, I was just sitting here and thinking and thinking, and I can be angry, I can be miserable, I can be depressed. But the actual reality, you know, for example, it meant nothing much is happening. You know, so that is an indication of how much our so-called these habits of us, which are what I say, our resistance to what is happening here and now, how much complication they introduce into our life, and likewise how much suffering they produce from us. And if we are all these things, life becomes, in a sense, quite simple. It's just this moment, and all I need to deal with is just one moment. If I don't think about my retirement plan, otherwise I get anxious. Oh, I don't have enough money in my CPF. Sometimes I think our society functions by, because I used to do marketing, by creating needs where there aren't any to start out with. If I can manage to make you anxious about something, you may want to buy my product as a way to allay your anxiety. Because from another point of view, like retirement is very important, right? Our government is very into it. We are also very into it. But actually, quite a number of us never get to see retirement. We just drop dead, and that's the end of our retirement plan, isn't it? So if you think like that, then we can say, oh, actually, a lot of things that I might have been feeling anxious about or worried about, or I really suffer over, they are, in a way, unreal. Or imagined, right? So maybe from that point of view, if we just come back to this moment here and now and just acknowledge what is here and just deal with what is here, life could be quite peaceful and simple, right? That's my simple-minded explanation of this profound truth. It's called the truth of cessation of suffering of the Buddha. Then next week, our last class, I will talk about the Buddhist path, you know, how we go about doing it, achieving it in our daily life, the different aspects of it that we can pay attention to that allow us to enjoy our unconditional peace. Okay, any last question? Is it peaceful just now? My meditation is always peaceful, isn't it? Yeah. Especially if you fall asleep, it's even more peaceful. Yeah. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. So have a good week. I'll see you next week. Yeah.
Oh, 1.5 hours finished. How did I manage to do that?
Thank you.
Bye, Yan.
Bye-bye.